Well, don't you need to pay?
I have to have that.
Okay, hi everybody. We're continuing this week with Masechet Soferim. We finished Perek Yud. We're looking at Perek Yud Aleph. Again, our main purpose is to try to point out what you might call the very unusual features. But Levaisa, there's a lot of basic halacha here as well. In Perek Yud Aleph, it begins with the very important rule that anyone that is Korei Batorah, every single aliyah, has to have a minimum of three psukim. Now, there are actually two different takanos of Chazal here. Obviously, every Shabbos, we read a whole parsha, right? But so that's kind of predetermined. But Monday and Thursday, technically, there is, the fact that you go up to Sheni is just purely a minhag. There is no particular magical reason why you have to do a whole aliyah. The requirement of a Kriya Satorah on Monday, Thursday, and Shabbos Mincha is 10 verses. Now the way it works, it is ten. 10 is the minimum that you need, but the way it works is an aliyah has to be 3, and one aliyah has to be 4, meaning 3, 3, 4. Purim is 9. Purim is the one exception. So, right. The Gemara itself points out that since the Kriya of Purim is the war against Amalek, that just ends with 9 psukim. So, you know, instead of going to another topic, you either stop at 9 or you repeat the last verse. But here, Masechet Soferim does say that every aliyah must have a minimum of 3 psukim. However, lo yikra lemiturgaman yaisir mipasach echad. Now, the miturgaman is a very important character that we don't have anymore, and that is, it used to be, that the Baal Korei, who would be the Ola himself, would read a verse, and then there would be a miturgaman, a person that would both translate the verse in Aramaic, which was the more common spoken language, even more than Lashon HaKodesh, and embellish it with midrashim and the like. So, for example, if you compare in the Chumash, Targum Unkelus, the Targum Yonasan ben Uziel, which is not really Yonasan ben Uziel, because the Gemara says he only wrote on the Nevi'im, he didn't write on the Torah, so they call it pseudo-Yonasan, or whatever you want to call it, but it is a Targum. So you'll see a very important difference. Targum Unkelus, besides the fact that the Aramaic dialect is a little different, that's a linguistic problem, but Targum Unkelus is a very, very literal Targum. You know, and it's, in fact, generally speaking, Unkelus even tries to keep the same number of words. If a pasuk has 10 words, the Unkelus will give you 10 words. He doesn't even want to use more than one word as a targum. Targum Yonasan ben Uziel, however, is very non-literal, and it's embellished by Midrashim, and of course, it's not that the author got it from Midrashim. The author was a Tana. So basically, he is a source of Midrashim. But it's been posited, and it's very, very logical, that the Targum Yonasan ben Uziel was in the nature of the oral Targum that Miturgamim used to do. So instead of having, like we have, well, not in every shul, but you know, these shuls that have drushos on Shabbos. I know in Eretz Yisrael they don't like the concept of a drusha. They don't like it in America either, but it tends to be more standard. So in a sense, every pasuk was a mini drusha. So things took a lot longer, in a sense. And Torah reading was not perceived as a davening thing. it was perceived as an educational thing. This was the Limud HaTorah in the middle of davening. This was the Meturgamen. So the Meturgamen is not only translation, it is embellishment, it is Midrashim, it is commentary, and the like the Targum Yonasan, or you have the Targum Yerushalmi, which is also, again, an unknown, an anonymous version. We have other Targumim as well. We have Targum in Syriac, as opposed to, that's how you pronounce it, instead of Aramaic. Syriac was also a dialect that was spoken in the Middle East.
Nowadays they call Syriac and Aramaic. They talk about Syriac and Aramaic.
Yes, it's not the same. It's not the same. It's a different.
Syrian.
The Syriac, and indeed, of course, if you go back to the Septuagint, the Targum HaShivim, you have Greek in Alexandria. That was the commonly spoken language. In fact, the Gemara discusses in Megillah, I mentioned it here as well, can a Sefer Torah be written in other languages? So the general halacha is no, but Rabbi Shimon Gamliel says Greek, this is classical Greek, ancient Greek was an exception, because that is nichlal in Noach's bracha, yafte lokim liyefes, God has given beauty to Yefes, the ancestor of Yavan, v'yishkain, and he may dwell, bi'alei shame, in the tense of shame. Shame is the not, that's in English, it sounds negative, but shame is shame ben Noach, that Greek gains admission within the temple of shame, and therefore, according to Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, you could actually write a Sefer Torah in Greek. Now, you may wonder, when Chazal addressed problems, or address issues, it's usually because it was a real issue. Like, what is the real issue here? Like, who would think of writing a Torah in English, right? We wouldn't think of a Torah scroll in English. Even the Reform movement doesn't have Torah scrolls in English. They have a...
Not yet.
Yeah. Yeah, right.
They don't have Torah scrolls.
They have Torah scrolls, right?
Yeah.
But we'll see, today gay marriage, tomorrow Torah scrolls in English, who knows where we're going to go. But the answer is that it actually is recorded that in the great Kehillah of Alexandria, which was a huge Jewish community, and if you remember, the Gemara even discusses the magnificent Beis Knesset, very wealthy community of Alexandria that was so big that you couldn't hear, not because of talking, but you couldn't hear the Chazan say Amen. They used to have flags for people to answer. And it was really, really wealth. And the truth is, Chazal, you have to read a little behind the lines. The poor Chazal that were living in Eretz Yisrael were actually describing this with a little bit of mockery, meaning to say, these are ignoramuses, these are people who are not so from, but they build magnificent edifices and temples, as opposed to Eretz Yisrael, where everything was poor, but there was Kedusha. But here's the thing. There is some evidence that the Kriyas HaTorah and even the Tefilos in Alexandria were conducted in Greek. There is some evidence. Even Philo of Alexandria, who was considered to be the most learned Jew, great philosopher, and he wrote on the Torah. He wrote Perushim on the Torah. Dr. Belkin of YU, Rabbi Belkin of YU's whole doctoral dissertation was on Philo and the Oral Law and the Torah Shebal Peh and the like. And Philo was, we're not sure exactly, but he seems to be a Shomer Mitzvos on some level. And yet there is some evidence, it's all speculative, nobody knows for sure, that perhaps he did not even know how to read Hebrew. And his whole limud was from the Septuagint, the Targum HaShivim. Now again, I don't want to say that as a fact. Historians argue over it. I'm not sure how they know one way or the other. But some have posited that his whole knowledge of the Torah came from the earlier Greek translation. So we have Targumim in Greek. We have Targumim in Syriac. We have Targumim in Aramaic and the like. In fact, we now have Targumim in Ivrit, right? I think they do for the army? They produced Tanakh written in modern Hebrew. So the biblical Hebrew gets retranslated.
On a tangent here, but if there was going to be a Sefer Torah, presumably it would have to be an agreed text.
Yes.
It couldn't just be somebody who happened to be...
No, that's correct. It would have to be, sure. Well, our Masoretic text is relatively well preserved.
The Greek text would have to be...
Oh, the Greek text, that's correct. Well, okay, that's an issue. I mean, the date of the Targum HaShivim is prior to Philo. So in Philo's time there already was. I don't know, over the years obviously corruptions get in. I don't know how...
I
authoritative that was.
So the idea, theoretically, was to use the Septuagint.
Yes. Typing. Yes. By the way, just to give you such an interesting aspect of a difference in Hashgafa, you know, Asura B'Teves, you know, we have a Tainus, and the technical reason of Asura B'Teves is that commemorates the day that Nebuchadnezzar began the siege against Yerushalayim that culminated in the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash 3.5 years later, till the 9th of Av, 3 years from that date. Right? It's the beginning of Peronius. But the Gemara actually says that, in fact, Asara B'Teves is one of 3 days. The 8th, the 9th, and the 10th should all be fast days. But the Chachamim, 3 days of fasting would be too difficult, even if you eat in the nights in between. And it mentions the following. It mentions, I don't remember which is the 8th and which is the 9th, but one of the days was the Petira of Ezra HaSeifer, Ezra. And Ezra was considered to be as great as Moshe Rabbeinu. Ezra was the spiritual leader of the Anshei Knesset HaGdola, who rebuilt Am Yisrael at the beginning of the Bayis Sheni, and that was considered to be a tremendous loss for Am Yisrael. And the other day was the day that the Targum HaShivim, the translation of the Torah into Greek, was completed, and that was considered to be, by the Chachamim, a great, great tragedy. Now, they don't identify clearly why is it so tragic. I mean, after all, they made the Torah more accessible to people who couldn't read Hebrew. So there are many different aspects of why this was considered to be not a great thing. Number one, by making the Torah accessible to more Jews, you're also making it accessible to non-Jews, who are then free to introduce distortions. That's one aspect. Number two, in fact, some say that's why Torah Shebaal Peh was not supposed to be written down, to keep it away from people who might introduce distortions. Number two, it was a very sad commentary on the Jewish people, that so many people could not read or understand the Torah in Lashon HaKodesh, and they had to do Greek. So in a sense, it was necessary, but it was not something that one would rejoice over. It's a very b'di'evit. And number three, in the Targum HaShivim itself, the Gemara tells us that a number of distortions were introduced in order not to get the king upset or whatever it is. So when there needs to be a falsification, a cover-up of the tochen of the Torah, that is also a tragic element, whether that was justified or not. But whatever it is, the Chachamim considered the Targum HaShivim to be a sad day in Am Yisrael. Also, I should also add maybe a fourth reason, and that is, we don't know which Chachamim were involved in that enterprise at all, but a number of their interpretations are connected to the mainstream Masorah of Chazal. So as a result, the Targum HaShivim itself contains ideas that are not acceptable to the majority of the Chachamim, and because of the translation, they gain much Pearson. And that itself is something. Now, that is why I remember when Art Scroll came out with their first, Art Scroll was an invitation company. In fact, it still is. Rabbi Meir Zlatowitz was a graphic artist. I don't know if he does that anymore. And he did invitations and ksuvos and the like. And what happened was, he had a friend that was nifter as a young man. So he thought he would do a little Megillas Esther. L'zecher Nishmasa. So like by the Shloshim, he produced a book of 150 pages or so on Megillas Esther. And, it was supposed to be a one-time thing, and then he would get back into the graphic art business. But from that one book came everything. So I remember there was an article, people were saying, this is wonderful, we finally have translations and commentaries that are Masoreti, that are traditional, I don't mean conservative, but are traditional, and it's as opposed to Bible critics and the like. But there was an article somebody wrote in the late Jewish Observer, not around anymore, in which somebody tried to compare this to the 3 days of darkness that descended with the Targum HaShivim, that B'nai Yeshiva have to look at an art scroll. Now, of course, they look at the art scroll for Gemara, not just for for Tanakh, because they're not capable of learning sources. So there's a mixed bag. But the reason I'm bringing this up is that Philo records that the Jewish community of Alexandria actually had their own Chag on the day, I don't remember what day of the calendar it was, but on the day that the Septuagint was completed, they made a chag, it was like a public, they made a siman, and they made a simcha, it was like their simchas Torah. So the very event that in Eretz Yisrael was viewed as a betrayal and something not positive was actually celebrated. So it was a very different community. And again, Rabbi Belkin explores, you know, did they have the Masorah, were they Makabal Torah Shel Mah, but still, even he concedes, there was a big, big merchak. It was, you might call them, in a sense, almost the first Reform Jews in some ways. Most of the community was not religious. Most of the community were assimilated. Philo was an exception, but Philo himself, at a minimum, we would call very, very modern left-wing Orthodox, at a minimum, because Philo participated in the athletic events and in the boxing match, and not as a boxer, but you know, he would go to these different events, and he very much was enamored with many, many aspects of Greek culture, which the Chachamim in Eretz Yisrael are very critical of. The Chachamim are always criticizing the circuses and the stadiums that you know, later the Romans built, but in Eretz Yisrael. And Antiochus is considered to be one of our great villains, not only because of his persecutions, but because of the Hellenist philosophy. So it's very fascinating. And in the ancient world, you had similar machloksin to what we have today within the different types of what you might call Orthodox or Torah Jews.
If one of the reasons for the 3 days of fasting is because Chazal decided it was too difficult,
right?
Isn't that shameful for us? The Arabs fast for a month. Seriously,
yes,
for a month. And we
can't
do it for 3 days. Look at the thing.
They always said that we're weak.
Well, it's a good, you know, it's a good question. That's an interesting question. I think you could look at it as Chazal's great compassion, and in their priority system, they felt that learning and davening and with kavana and energy was ultimately more important than fasting. And if there's going to be a trade-off, because fasting generally a person's unable to daven as well, they thought in the hierarchy of values, tefillah and Torah was more important. You know, you're right.
They have
to
work.
Yeah, briskers. You told me briskers don't fast except for Tisha B'Av and Yom Kippur. Okay. All right. Okay. Now that's interesting because I know Hasidim are also very makel for women. Hasidim basically tell women automatically you only fast on Tisha B'Av and Yom Kippur. It's not even a hava amina of fasting for the other. Including Tanya Sester, right. Okay, so one other thing, because the reason I'm bringing all this in is because the Masechet Sofrim introduces the Meturgamen here. Let me just mention a very, very interesting hesber that is given for a halacha. We know on the first day of Shavuos, before Kriyas HaTorah of the Aseret HaDibros, we read Akdamas, right? Akdamas is an Aramaic poem, written by Rav Meir Barav Yitzchak, who was a Rebbe of a Rebbe of Rashi, you know, earlier, much earlier than Rashi. And it's a poem about the greatness of Am Yisrael and the fact that the Umos HaOlam taunt Am Yisrael, but they're Moser Nefesh. And it talks graphically about the rewards in Olam Haba using very physical metaphors of table, gold tables and jewels. And it uses very much of a physical. And every line of Akdamas is drawn from Midrashim. In fact, our scroll is very good commentary on Akdamas, but all the Meforshim will show you that every single description is drawn from a Targum, from a Medrash, from a Gemara, etc., and you can actually see the actual wording that way. But it's a very difficult Aramaic. It is a pure Aramaic. It is not the Aramaic, you know, mixed with Hebrew or whatever. It's like 100% Aramaic. So it's difficult for a non-Aramaic speaker. Most of us are not Aramaic speakers. To be able to follow, so you'll have to ask the old woman in Syria, you know, who knows, you know, who speaks Aramaic as a native language, or the Kurds, right? But there was it was interesting the following: the original minhag of Akdamos was after the Ola recited the bracha rishona, and the Baal Koreh read the first pasuk, Bachodesh Hashlishi. Latseis b'nei Yisrael me'eretz Mitzrayim b'yom hazeh bo midbar Sinai, Akdamos was read. This, it is recorded in the Rishonim that the minhag of Akdamos is after the kriya of after the bracha and the first pasuk, the ola, the whoever it is, either the ola or whoever the chazan is, says Akdamos.
There's a difference
Yeah, some places do that.
But that absolutely
is the original minute of Akdamas. However, for most Ashkenazim, not all, most Ashkenazim, that minhag became batel in the 17th century. Really, one person is responsible for being mevatel the minhag, and this is the Taz. The Taz was the Rav David Segel Halevi in Poland, and the Taz was one of the great poskim. He was the son-in-law of the Bach, but a very great poskim in his own right. And the Taz claimed this minhag cannot be correct, because you're not allowed to be mafsik. Once you have Kriyas HaTorah, you don't make interruptions till the end of an aliyah. So how can you have Akdamos in the middle? It is a hefsik. And therefore the Taz was said, this is a minhag bita'ut, a minhag that is a mistake. And as a result, he single-handedly moved Akdamos before the Bracha Rishona, right before the aliyah. Before the Kriya at least, even before the Aliyah. And this has been followed by the majority of Ashkenazic Kehilos that we do Akdamas before. So the question is, though, historically, there's no doubt. I mean, if the Taz was trying to make the historical assertion that this was a mistake and this was a deviation, it absolutely was not a deviation. The Taz is deviating from. Yeah. So how do you justify the original minhag? So, there is a thought, which makes a lot of sense, that at the time that Rav Meir Rav Yitzchak wrote Akdamas, before Rashi, the minhag, even in Eastern Europe, was still to have a meturgeman. So as a result, every single pasuk was followed by an Aramaic translation. So Akdamut is simply the Hakdama. Akdamas means introduction. It is the Hakdama to the Targum that we're going to say. Now obviously, the Targum was not treated as a hefsek. The Targum was part and parcel of the Etzem Kriya. Now what happened was, at various times, and it's hard for us to pinpoint the exact time, Ashkenazim stopped the minhag of Targum. Taimonim held on to it. In fact, Taimonim still do Targum, right? Some do. But Taimonim held on to it for a very long time. But among Ashkenazim and most Sephardim, Targum dropped out for a very simple reason, because it's kind of a catch-22. Aramaic was no longer such a meaningful language for them, and they didn't feel comfortable substituting a vernacular for Aramaic because it didn't have the Kedusha. So there was no point in a Targum that people didn't understand. They didn't feel that had the kedusha of Aramaic, because Aramaic was the language of Chazal. So the net result was they took out the Targum, but they left Akdamas because that was a special. So on that, the Taz says, if all you're doing is Akdamas, that's called a hefsik. So it's very interesting. Therefore, the original minhag was totally justifiable, but once you deleted the Targum, then Akdamas becomes hefsik. That's a very, very plausible interpretation of the evolution of the minhagim. Again, but it's interesting. I don't know if we have it. I'd like to look into it myself. I don't know if we have exact pinpointing dates of when the maturgaman aspect died out. It probably did. It certainly did not die out at one time. In other words, it's died out here and there and there and there and there, and then eventually. Akdamas? Akdamas would be 9th or 10th century, yeah.
So you're saying that it's possible that there was a maturgam up until that point?
Yes, yes.
In Ashkenaz?
Yes, yes, yes. The alternative is, there is some evidence, again, I'm not an expert in this, that Rav Meir Rav Yitzchak actually came from Bavel. He lived in Germany. That's undoubtedly the case. He lived in Ashkenaz. But some say he's Iraqi. Some say he's Babylonian. So it could be that maybe he wrote Akdamas in connection with the Babylonian minhag, which undoubtedly did keep Targum, because Aramaic was their language. Huh? About where the Ashkenazim came from? It might be a little bit of a confirmation, but some say this was an isolated case. Some say, just an isolated person who found himself there. It was not indicative of a migration pattern. Huh?
I mean, if he was an isolated person, it's not so clear that the community he could write it, but that doesn't mean everybody's going to say it.
He was a man of stature, I tell you. He was a gadol, whatever. Hey, gadol shows up, so he's given a lot of respect. Similarly, the same thing is true. It's very fascinating. that in the Gola, not here, where you have a second day of Shavuos, you will remember, if your memories go back long enough to the old years, that there is a poem, Yatsiv Piskam, the Haftorah. It is now, this is the Haftorah. This is the Haftorah, Yatsiv Piskam. And once again, now there we taka do it after the first pasuk of the Haftorah. There we don't, we're less concerned about Hefzik for whatever reason. But at the end, there's a fascinating thing. The same theory goes that this was the Hakdama to the Targum of the Nevi'im, which also had a Targum. And the last line of Yitziv Piskam may confirm this, although the Art Scroll translates it differently. It says, Invasan Gevar Yonatan, that we hereby declare that Yonatan is a humble man, and we extend to him our gratitude. So who is this Yonatan that you're giving thanks to? So the Targum of the Nevi'im is indeed Yonatan ben Uziel. And therefore, as the Hakdama to the Targum, we are expressing gratitude to Yonatan ben Uziel. Now, it makes no sense if you don't have a Targum. So the Art Scroll translates Yehonatan as one of the names of Moshe Rabbeinu. The Gemara says in Sota that Moshe Rabbeinu had many names, and Yehonatan is Ka Nasan, Hashem gave. You know, the so they translate it just to make it about Shavuos, about Matan Torah. But it's very, very probable that the original meaning was, we're now going to learn Yonatan ben Uziel's interpretations. We want to thank him for giving us the Targum of the Nevi'im. So it's interesting that both in the Kriya of the first day and in the Haftorah, in the Goliot of the second day, there is still the Zecher of the Targumim, one for Torah, one for Haftorah, that is represented by Akdomas and by Yitziv Piskam. So once again, it's kind of a remez of that even when the reason for something ceases, but it remains part of Klal Yisrael, because there's still some connection to the past that we have.
The singer, American version of the English.
Yeah.
The authorized version.
Yeah.
Isn't it appearing there in the American version?
What, you see Piskam?
Yeah.
I assume it does. Every American sitter has Yitziv. You know, Yitziv Piskam is in every American sitter. In Eretz Yisrael, you have no occasion to say it, because it's only for the second day of Shavuos.
When did they stop speaking Aramaic in Babel? Didn't they go on him writing in Arabic already?
I'm not sure. Obviously, with the Islamic conquest of Iraq, so Arabic became a more dominant language. And that already, the conquest was pretty early. The conquest was already in the 7th century, wasn't it? The 600s. Right after the finishing of the Gemara. So it's interesting. The Gemara goes right up to, basically, the Gemara is pre-Islam, but right after the Chasimas HaShas already comes the Islamic conquest. But I'm not sure. Again, these things don't happen overnight, and these things don't happen all at once.
The Gaonim wrote in Arabic.
The Gaonim main. Now again, Aramaic may have been their official language. Their tshuvot are written largely in Aramaic. Yeah, the tshuvot of Gaonim are almost always in Aramaic. But already by the Rif, now the Rif is already after the Gaonim, the Rif's vernacular was Arabic. In fact, the Rif wrote the halachos in Rabbinic language, Aramaic, Hebrew. But occasionally, it's interesting, when there are some very difficult sugyas, the Rif wrote an Arabic interpretation of some sugyas, which later got translated into Hebrew. But you can see, when you learn the Rif, it'll say, this sugya, the Rif interpreted Balashan RV, and we translated it this way. So already Arabic, the Rif was in Morocco, already in Morocco, Arabic was the spoken language, but that's already, again, after the Gaonim, so I just don't know all the dates. But none of this happens at once, and different cities did it different times. I don't know. And it's certainly possible that Arabic coexisted with Aramaic for a considerable amount of time.
There's a lot of similarity between the two languages.
Yeah, they are similar. Obviously, they're very similar, but they are two different languages with a common connection. Okay, so what it says here about, this is kind of a hakdama for Mitzvah, that I think is interesting, but it mentions here the following, that although every Ola has to have three verses, but the Meturgaman should do only one verse at a time, because the concept would be that if I'm reading the Torah, if I read three verses and then you're supposed to translate them, you're not going to really remember. So I should read one verse and you translate, one verse and you translate, one verse and you translate. You don't give the Meturgaman more than one pasuk. Now the implication is, though, that you do have to give him a whole pasuk, which is interesting, because a pasuk might sometimes be relatively long, and the Meturgaman is supposed to remember the whole pasuk, but that we do have some minimum requirements. Now it then says, Ubanavi Shalosha, that this requirement that you never give the Meturgaman more than one pasuk to translate at a time only applies to Torah reading. But in the Haftorah, you can give them up to three. Reason is, not because the verses are shorter, but because if there's any omission, it is not as fatal. So to say, in the Torah, Chazal were very, very concerned that the Meturgaman not omit any detail in the verse at all, so you don't give him too many words to have to remember. By the Navi, we're mekel if he leaves out something, not that it's good, but we're less concerned for takala, and therefore we can give him up to three psukim. But the exception to that is im shalashtan shashalosh parshios. Right? What are parshios? Remember the term parshios. Parshios in Chazal does not refer to the parshas haShavua or anything. It refers to the paragraph divisions in Torah, Nevi'im, and Kesuvim. And these paragraph divisions are either psuchos or stumos. Psuchos generally means that a paragraph ends in the middle of a line and you leave the rest of the line blank. That's why it's called patuach, and you begin the next paragraph on the next line. Stuma is that if it ends in the middle of a line, you begin on the same line, but you leave a break of nine letters. That is called a satuma. Now you might think that's unimportant. I do want to emphasize that is ma'akev. Now again, you wouldn't know it because unless you're a bucky, you know the Torah by heart, you're not going to notice these mistakes unless you're a bucky. But if a Torah is not written in accordance with psuchos and stumos, the Sefer Torah is puzzle. It is ma'akev even b'di'evin. And even Nevi'im and Kesuvim on a klaf are supposed to be written with psuchos and stumos. And sometimes psuchos and stumos might be less than three psukim. In other words, this might be a very short paragraph. So if the Haftorah has a lot of these small paragraphs, then you should not give the Navi. Let's say you have a parsha that only has two verses. You only read two verses. You don't read three because you don't want to give the Meturgaman to remember two different parshios.
Just on technical matter, what do you do with the one or two instances in the Torah where a pasuk doesn't end at the end of a parsha?
Yeah. So okay, we're going to see. Let me get ahead of myself. There are basic rules like this. An aliyah has to be a minimum of three psukim. That's correct. However, there's another rule that's a corollary. It's a derivative of that rule, and that is you're not allowed to end an aliyah less than three psukim before the end of a paragraph. I mean, let's say a parsha, and I don't care if it's psucha or stuma, it makes no difference. A parsha only has five psukim. So you might think, well, all right, first guy reads three, second guy reads two, and one into the next one. Each one has three psukim. What's the problem? Well, in terms of your number, there is no problem. But there's a rabbinic enactment. The rabbinic enactment is, if the first aliyah ends after 1, 2, 3, leaving over 4 and 5, and somebody walks out of shul, he has to go somewhere, he's going to logically think that the next aliyah is going to end at the end of a paragraph, because normally aliyahs tended to end there. So he's going to think that the next aliyah is only going to be two psukim. So even if the next aliyah is not going to be two psukim, you're not allowed to end an aliyah within less than three psukim from the end, because the yotzin the Yotzin are going to think the next lay will only have two. Ah, now, so therefore, you have to end always leaving three psukim before the ending. Now, the same thing is true for the beginning. That let's say we have five psukim, right? So first guy, I'm sorry, let's say six psukim. So you have one, two, three. Second guy says one, two, three. But let's say we want to give him a longer aliyah. So we give him the last three and we give him the first two. So there's another rule. You can't end an aliyah within three psukim of the beginning of a parsha. And the reason is because of newcomers who come late. Because they come in and they see a new aliyah starting in pasuk 3, pasuk gimel, they're going to think the prior aliyah was only 1 and 2. Because they figure that aliyahs tend to begin at the beginning of paragraphs. So because of this, this is a very, very important thing. This is the most important rule, that if you're making haysafas and you're adding aliyahs, and you got to figure out where you can stop. So, you know, most people know, but that's only a minute. You know, you don't stop with a good, bad thing, only a good, okay, that's fine, but those are minhagim. But the absolute halacha of a haysafa is, you can never end an aliyah if you're leaving less than three psukim before the end of the paragraph, and you cannot end an aliyah if you have not yet read three psukim from the beginning of a paragraph. So you have to end an aliyah leaving three to the end and having three from the beginning. That is the absolute rule about hosafas. And then you do with other things about middle of an inyan, you try to logically finish a topic, you don't want to end with a bad thing, you don't want to begin with a bad thing. Those are other inyanim, which also have a makar in Masechet Sefarim as well. But that only comes after you've determined when you, you know, where you can end, right? This is a very, very important rule. And this is a gezeira. But it's interesting how Chazal was so machmir, because the din that you have to have three psukim is a drabbanan dika din. And yet the chachamim are so concerned that even if somebody has three psukim, we're concerned with latecomers who come in and people who leave, that they're gonna think it wasn't three psukim. Well, I mean, that's not the biggest aveira in the world.
Thread running through a number of things that you've said over the last few weeks. So this concern for people who don't get to shul on time.
That's right. That's right. Why do I care about them, right? That's their problem. Well, it's a good question. You see that Chazal care about latecomers. Now, maybe they don't care about latecomers per se, but they care about the misconceptions that latecomers will have, in which they'll tell their friends and neighbors. In fact, if anything, it might be a negative statement about latecomers who are going to misinterpret what is going on, and they're not going to ask the chachamim, right? So if anything, maybe it's a criticism of latecomers instead of a statement of support and the like. Yeah. So this is an important rule. Okay. Now, it then mentions a very interesting aspect. What if you have a city which only, or a minyan, a shul, that only has one person who is capable of reading? So here it mentions he gets all the aliyos as long as he sits between one aliyah. Now let me explain, this is not relevant today. This is referring to the original minhag where the ole read, right? The one who, and remember, in the time of Masechet Sofrim, which is still the time of the Mishnah, you actually had the first ole said the bracha rishona, the last ole said a bracha achrona, and the middle people, the five middle people, didn't make a bracha at all. So now, given that reality, our problem is, what if I'm in a shul where literally only one person is able to read the Torah? So what you actually do is, you still go through the form in which he's called up first, whether he's a Kohen or not. He makes bracha rishona. He reads the whole parsha and he makes a bracha achrona, but it should take the form of seven olim, which means he has to sit down. In other words, he reads until sheni, he sits down, he gets up, reads until shlishi, sits down. So it has to still have the tzura of seven, or Monday and Thursday, three olim l'torah. Now, this would not be relevant today, generally speaking, because we just have one Baal Koreh, so even if there's only one guy that can read, so what? We will call up the different Olim. The interesting question, though, is, would this be relevant if you had to make separate brachas? I mean, meaning like this. Let's say, in other words, the original minhag was first Ola made bracha rishona, last Ola made bracha achrona. So if you have one guy, ultimately there's only going to be one bracha, so it's not a big deal. But let's say we then move to stage two, where the Ola still reads his own portion, but he makes his own bracha. Would we say, under those circumstances, that the same guy gets up seven times and makes a bracha each time? In other words, would you apply the Maseches Sofrim rule even when the Ola makes the bracha seven times? Or would we say that doesn't make sense? We're not going to have one person make the bracha 14 times, you know, seven, one.
You see with the coin, that yep. There's no lady, you can say.
Right. So the Chari do have a raya that it is permitted for one person to have multiple aliyahs. The best example is, that's right, Simchas Torah, but a Kohen, right? That if there's no Kohen, oh, I'm sorry, if there's no Levi, so the Makom Levi, the Kohen makes two brachas. So based on that idea, it would appear that the rule of Maseches Sofrim, that the Koreh, who is Koreh seven times, Uvilvad Sheyeshev, Ben Kriya Lekriya, would even apply if he were to make a bracha rishona achrona, because every aliyah is considered to be a new maisa mitzvah. So instead of saying that he simply reads continuously, Maseches Sofrim says he actually sits between the aliyahs, so you have seven people, or not seven people, but seven occurrences of getting up and reading the Torah.
So this also means that if you only had the only one who could read was a Kohen or a Yisrael, Levi or Yisrael, you wouldn't call a Kohen.
In those days, yeah, that's correct. In other words, when you didn't have a Baal Koreh, that's 100% correct. The Kohen would be out of the game
if the Kohen couldn't read.
We would not call the Kohen. That's correct. There was no Kohen. That's correct. It's Kilo, there's no Kohen, and you wouldn't do it. Okay. Now. All right. Now, then, the Mishnah goes on, or not the Mishnah, the Braisa goes on with another halacha called Medalgin Benavi Ve'ein Medalgin B'Torah. Now, Medalgin Benavi basically means this: when you read a haftarah, the Chachamim did not require that the reading be consecutive. And in fact, now again, most of our haftarahs are consecutive. Occasionally, though, there are breaks. So, for example, in the Haftarah of Shabbos Shuvah, you read portions of Hosea, and then Yoel, and then Micha, etc. The Chachamim did not require that readings of the Haftarah be consecutive. You are permitted the idea of Diluk. But in the Kriya of the Torah, even though all you need on Monday and Thursday are 10 Psukim or 9 Psukim, but the 9 Psukim have to be consecutive. Now, we're going to see in a moment, there is one Kriya Satorah in which we do skip. We do skip around, and that is Vayichal. Vayichal is the Kriya Satorah of Moshe praying for the after the Chet HaEgel, and we read it on a Tainis Sibor. Mincha of a Tainis Sibor.
Yeah.
Huh? Say again? Well, Rosh Chodesh is read more often. But whatever. But Vayichal is read Tainis Mincha and Shachris. On Tisha B'Av, there's a different Kriya for Shachris, so it's read Mincha of Tisha B'Av. But you'll recall, if you follow in a Chumash, you'll recall that in Vayichal we do skip. Right? So the Gemara, now Maseches Sofrim will actually give you an answer for that. But as a general rule, it mentions that we permit non-consecutive reading in the Haftorah. We permit. Now, most of the time we don't do it, but it is permissible. So if a Chacham were to say that he likes, you know, this part of Haftarah and this part, so you'd be allowed to do it. But in the Torah, the readings must be consecutive. But he gives a distinction here, and that is that you're allowed to skip if you could get to the place you need to go before the Meturgaman finished his Targum. Which means like this. I read a Pasuk, and the Meturgaman is interpreting. If I could get to the place I want to go, where I'm structured to go, before the Meturgaman finishes his Targum, again, this is based on averages, so you would be allowed to skip. So the theory is that the skipping within Vayichal is within the shiur of bichdei sheyifsaik hamaturgaman, and therefore it's mutter. Now, this seems to suggest the following idea. This seems to suggest, and the question is, why by Nevi'im don't we care about this, that the concern with skipping around is not a concern with skipping around per se, but it's a concern of being matriach the tzibor as you're looking for the new place to go. So if the place you're going to go is so close that you're able to get there before the Meturgaman finishes, there is no tircha de tzibura, and that would be mutter. Now the problem with that is, the implication is that we make a chiluk between Nevi'im and Torah. And you then tell me, even by Torah, you're allowed to skip if it's the shir of Kadesh Yifzik HaMeturgaman. The implication is that by Nevi'im, you're allowed to skip even if it takes longer. Question is, why is that? I mean, if the concern would be, once again, the sanctity of the Torah is such that we don't allow skipping. Okay, I understand that. But if the concern is simply tircha de tzibura, not to make the tzibur wait. In fact, this is why we have the institution, although it doesn't really work this way. Why do we have two Sifrei Torah? Right? Because we have a mafter, which is sometimes, why don't I just take one Sefer Torah, which sometimes you gotta do, and roll it? Answer once again is, the institution of a pre-rolled second Torah was created exactly because of this, in order to minimize, in theory, sometimes it doesn't work that way, to minimize tircha de tzibura, right? That's exactly the principle of shtei sifrei Torah. So according to Maseches Sofrim, the general rule of ein medalgin is an expression of tircha de tzibura. So why would we not have the identical problem for Haftorah? I'm not sure. I don't know the logic for this. Unless maybe it depends how you understand tircha de tzibura. Maybe tircha de tzibura, it's a chiddush, I don't think that's the way it is not an intrinsic concern for the tzibur. But maybe it's a concern that if people get disgusted because of delays, they'll walk out and not listen. So mimele, for Haftorah, we're less concerned. All right, they walk out. It's not a good thing, but we're not so worried about it.
Maybe we'll worry that they'll talk.
Or they'll talk. Okay, could be. Yeah. But this is a kasha, meaning to say, this chiluk between Torah and Nevi'im is difficult in light of this principle, Kedei Sheyifzok HaMeturgaman. And the like. Okay. Now, Maseches Sofrim alludes, though, to the very interesting minog of the Kohen Gadol on Yom Kippur that departs from some of these rules. Remember on Yom Kippur, when there was, this is during the Beis HaMikdash, all of the Kriyas HaTorah, the whole Avodah, everything, was done by the Kohen Gadol. In fact, you get the impression, it couldn't have been totally true, when you read Maseches Yuma, which is 7 out of 8 prakim is not about the fast of Yom Kippur. It's all about the avoda in the Beis HaMikdash. Yuma is really a meseches that is much more shaychus to Seder Kodshim than it does to Seder Moed. So you get the impression Yom Kippur was kind of a spectator sport. You're just a bunch of people hanging around, watching the Kohen Gadol work himself into exhaustion. Here. You have to do everything. In other words, not just the Yom Kippur Korbanos. You did the Korban Tamid and the Ketores and the Musafin, all sorts of things. Baruch Hashem, the one thing he didn't have to do is he wasn't the one that took the goat out to the desert. Somebody else did that one. But okay. But anyway, in addition, he was the Bal Kore. And he had the only aliyah, right? The only, you know, Kohen Gadol had the aliyah, and he recited 8 brachos, you know, afterwards. You know, it said it was many, many brachos. But it mentions the following. He took a Sefer Torah, he read Parshas Acharei Mos, which is our Yom Kippur reading, that is the Avodah of Yom Kippur, and then he went to the Maftir in Parshas Emor. Emor is the Parsha of all the holidays, so there's Ach V'Yasor, there is a paragraph of Yom Kippur. And then the third mention of Yom Kippur is in Parshas Pinchas. And that he read Al Peh, that he didn't. And the Gemara says the following. The Gemara asks a lot of questions. The Gemara says, why do we allow him to go, be Golel to Parshas Emor? Let's take out another Sefer Torah. So the Gemara explains the following. That when you have a single Ola, you're not motzi another Sefer Torah, because Bishlamo, when there are two different Olam, that's fine. When it's the same Ola and you take out another Sefer Torah, people will think the first Sefer Torah was puzzle. So in order not to cast dispersions on the first Sefer Torah, this is where he rolls it. But the Gemara points out, well, if in a sense you're mevater on tefillah, on tircha d'tzibura, by making him roll it to Parshas Emor, then why don't you have him roll it to Parshas Pinchas? Why is he korei al peh? So the Gemara makes this difference, that from Acharei Mos to Emor is a relatively short roll, and that could still be within the amount of time it would take the Meturgaman to finish his Targum, as opposed to Parshas Pinchas, which is more than the shear. Parshas Pinchas is towards the end of Bamidbar. It's more than the shear of Kedei Sheyifsok HaMeturgaman. So as a result, the Kohen Gadol has a dilemma. We're not going to take out a pre-rolled Torah scroll, because when you have one Ola, you don't want to cast dispersions. Right, so what are our choices? To roll it all the way there is Tircha D'Tzibura. To have a pre-rolled Torah scroll when you have only one person reading is a Pagam on the first Sefer. So neither solution is possible. So in such a case, we go to the third thing, and that is, he recites it Baal Peh.
But you're not supposed to learn.
Which you're not supposed to do. But he recites it. He has a card or whatever it is, and he just reads it, which you're not supposed to do normally, because it's Kriyas HaTorah. But that's the only thing that can be done. Now today, obviously, if your maftir is Parshas Pinchas, you have a pre-rolled Sefer Torah. And as long as you have two, in other words, the problem of Pagam Shel Rishon is only when it's one Ola. When you have a separate Ola, it's not a Pagam anymore, because you have a separate Torah for each Ola. Right? So Yom Kippur was a little different, but even Yom Kippur is reflective of the idea that we make a chiluk between being Golel within the shear of Kadesh Yifsuk HaMeturgaman and being Golel beyond the shear of Kadesh Yifsuk HaMeturgaman. Yeah.
The implication of what you're saying as far as Torah, yeah. This is Yom Kippur.
This is Yom Kippur.
Yom Kippur is mechaper with tshuva, without tshuva, tefillah, without tefillah.
Yeah, but if anything,
they could walk out.
Well, I would answer for Keret. They don't have to be in the Beis HaMikdash. The Kohen Gadol was doing the work for them. I mean, if anything, walking out is even more plausible in the Beis HaMikdash, because they don't need to be there. Most people were not there. Yeah, most people were not there. Yeah, but this is, again, these are special rules for the Kohen Gadol in the Beis HaMikdash, that he was also the Baal Korei, and then he resumed the Avoda afterwards. It is not recorded, by the way, that in the Beis HaMikdash there was any Haftarah. I'm not sure how that worked. In fact, the Mishnah in Yuma does not mention Tefillah at all in the Beis HaMikdash. And it mentions Kriyas HaTorah, and it assigns a place for Kriyas HaTorah, an exact location.
Well, the Haftarah came much later after the Romans.
Well, no, the Haftarah, I believe they date from the time of... No, but that's from the Chashmonaim. I mean, it's Antiochus. So by the time the Mishnah was written, there was a Haftarah. The Mishnah makes reference. But again, one of the things that, again, this is more historical than Halacha, is different parts of the Mishnah referring to the Avoda can date from different time frames within the Beis HaMikdash. Meaning, Rav Yehuda HaNasi, in effect, incorporated earlier descriptions of the Seder Avodah. In fact, many have said that the descriptions of the Beis HaMikdash, although were the earliest part of the Mishnah, Rav Yehuda Halevi was, Rav Yehuda HaNasi was working off prior descriptions. So it could very well be that the prior descriptions might be older than the meaning of Haftorah. That may be the case. But certainly there were years in the Bayit Sheni that there was Haftorah. So now, I don't know if the Kohen Gadol did it or somebody else did it or whatever it was. Okay. Alrighty. So that covers the first three halachos. Maybe we'll stop here for that. Okay. Yeah. All right. You have a good Shabbos, a good fast. You know, people always have this debate about Tzom Kal, famous debate. Tzom Kal, you know, should it be a Tzom Kal or should it be a meaningful fast, etc. So you should have a meaningful fast, and the discomfort of being hungry should not overwhelm our ability to contemplate and do tshuva for the averus that caused the korban and the cheder egel and everything else. Okay.
Yeah.